So in lecture 11, what I really want to do is introduce you to some more sophisticated ideas in this sort of context. So I'm going to introduce a bunch of things. I don't expect you to have quite the same depth of insight, perhaps, over these things as you would otherwise. It's more a way of opening your eyes to some of the wider possibilities that exist in this sort of area. So the thing I want to talk about first is self-similarity. I've already mentioned this a little bit in the context of music, but the standard idea of self-similarity can be traced back a long way to the 18th century. So there's this nice little poem, and one of the things that I found is when I was trying to write up notes for this course, I tried to remember this poem. And then eventually I realized I couldn't remember it because I kept getting bits of it wrong. And so I googled it, and I found out part of the reason I kept getting bits of it wrong is there's actually at least two different versions of this poem from different eras almost. The earliest one is this one: "So naturalists observe a flea, how smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite him, and so proceed ad infinitum." So it's a nice little neat poem which expresses the idea of self-similarity. The idea is you have these fleas, and on them they have little fleas, and then there are little fleas, and littler fleas, and as you zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, you see the same thing again and again and again. So actually, perhaps in nature they're not exactly the same. Maybe the fleas that bite fleas don't look exactly the same, but you see similar sorts of things. This is an example called the Cantor dust. What I've done here is I took a straight line, and I chopped out the middle third of it, and then I chopped out the middle third of the bits that were left, and then I chopped out the middle third, and I chopped out the middle third. And if you continue that on forever, you end up with the Cantor dust, which is a set of points on the real number line. It has some interesting properties. As you zoom in and zoom in on that Cantor dust, you see the same structure again and again and again. It has what we call self-similarity, or a fractal structure. Another example is the Koch snowflake. Take a triangle, and on each side of the triangle, add another triangle. And then do the same, and the same, and the same. And if you continue that on forever, you end up with, again, a fractal, self-similar structure. So if I zoom in and in and in on this thing, in and in and in on deeper and deeper bits of it, I see the same thing being replicated again and again. Now, as I said, with fleas, for instance, you don't necessarily see a flea with an exact flea smaller biting that flea. But you might see some sort of parasite on that flea. So what we see when we do these zoomings in, these sort of self-similar transformations, is not necessarily exactly the same thing. In this example of a little fern, what I have when I zoom in on this square is not exactly the same as this fern. It's a transform of it, though, a very simple sort of linear transform. It's just this thing skewed over. Same thing. How do I know it's the same but just skewed over? Well, this is not a real picture of a fern. This is a picture I generated using some C code, which generates a fractal. Specifically generates a fractal. And so I know that this part here is directly related to this rest of this fern over here, generated by what people call iterated function system. More complicated fractals, you don't even necessarily see things that are all that close to each other. You see, say, for instance, this is the Mandelbrot set, a very famous fractal. This sort of structure here looks like it's somewhat replicated up there, but actually we know that it's not exactly the same, not even under some sort of transform. Look at it a bit closer, and it has that tree-like sort of structure, whereas this one has this sort of straight bit coming out of the end. The Mandelbrot set generates these very beautiful pictures that you may have seen from time to time around the place. So, self-similarity is very interesting. Part of the reason it's interesting, I guess in the 19th century people started talking about smooth functions a lot. And in this course I've mostly restricted myself to functions, say, in L2, you know, they have a certain amount of regularity, these functions. One of the really interesting things that happened in the 20th century was people realized those functions couldn't capture all of the behavior you saw in nature. whereas these fractals can capture a lot of that sort of behavior. So people were very interested in this. The sort of fractals that I've shown you so far, though, are deterministic fractals. They have deterministic structure, and we're interested in stochastic self-similarity in this course. So the analogy here is the difference between looking at something like a sine wave and looking at white noise. We're interested in both sorts of things, really, but sine waves, they're kind of simple. White noise has this interesting stochastic behavior, and we're interested in the stochastic analog of self-similarity. So here's an example of that. This is an example called fractional Brownian motion. And in fractional Brownian motion, you have some sort of random process, which I've shown with this blue curve. Then I've zoomed in on this region, this red region, and blown it up here. Then I zoom in on this green region, and I've blown it up here. And you can see they don't look exactly the same. It's not exactly self-similar, not deterministically self-similar. But they have the same statistical characteristics. And that's the important thing. The statistical characteristics of this green curve, this red curve, and this blue curve are the same with the appropriate scaling, the zoom. So they have this statistical self-similarity property. Why do we care about statistically self-similar processes? Well, I personally care about them because, again, my area of research, the area I work with various companies on, is analysis of networks, analysis of traffic on networks. And traffic on networks exhibits this property. So I'm not going to tell you much about the blue curve. That's really there as a contrasting example which doesn't satisfy this property. But you look at this. This is telling you the number of packets on an Ethernet. And the time interval here is 1/100th of a second. So this is telling you the number of packets every 1/100th of a second on that Ethernet. If I take these numbers and I average them so that I have them now in blocks of 100. So now this graph is showing me the number of packets every 100 seconds. Every second, and this is showing me the number every 100 seconds. This black line here corresponds to this whole chunk of the graph up there. You can see there's something of a statistical self-similarity between these three graphs. There's variation here, there's variation here, there's variation here. This one starts to look a little bit different at this sort of time scale. But over 5 orders of magnitude or 6 orders of magnitude, you typically see the same sort of picture, which just looks like some sort of noise. It's not white noise though, because white noise would do this. When I averaged it more and more, it would get smoother and smoother. That's what a moving average does. Moving average smooths away our white noise. Why is that? Well, white noise, when we look at it in the frequency domain, its power is spread over the whole frequency, the whole domain. Its spectral density is flat. So its power is spread over all frequencies. So when I do a moving average, think of that as a low-pass filter, I'm getting rid of some of that energy. So I smooth it. I get a smoother picture. What's happening here? Well, what's happening here must be, this is not responding to that low-pass filter. So the power here in the energy of the signal can't be in the high frequencies. So when I think about this noise process, it must be quite different from a white noise process. If you think about it in the spectral domain, most of its power must actually be in low frequencies. But okay, so if I put all of its power into low frequencies, I get something that changed really slowly. So that can't be how it works, can it? It's a bit confusing at this point. I have a formal definition of self-similarity here, but we don't really need to know this for this course. And I have a couple of other bits of self-similar traffic here. So this is fractional Gaussian noise with a Hertz parameter H equal to 0.5, which actually corresponds to Gaussian noise, white Gaussian noise. Yeah, so this would be my white noise. This is my fractional Gaussian noise as I each increase the Hertz parameter, which increases the degree of self-similarity, 0.9. Now you can see this is actually a bit different once I get H up to about 0.99. It looks quite qualitatively different as a noise process. Again, I have a bunch of formal bits of math here. I don't expect you to remember this stuff. Telling us about the autocorrelation function of these sort of self-similar processes. The interesting thing though, from our point of view, is that from this we can derive a form of the autocorrelation function which looks like this. It has power law decay here. The autocorrelation function decays slowly. This power law is a slow thing compared with exponential decay. Think about white noise. White noise has zero correlation outside of, you know, each individual point is uncorrelated. We showed that earlier on in the course. Typically with a process like this, if we take a sum over these autocorrelations from any point out in the tail of this function out to infinity, that sum will diverge. What that's saying is that this autocorrelation decays slowly enough that it's always significant. Doesn't ever disappear. And so we call this a long memory process, or a long range dependent process, because things a long way in the past are correlated with the present. The history from a long time ago affects the present. The first example of this that people came across was Nile River data. And the reason they looked at Nile River data was we have records for the Nile River floods that go back to the time of Egypt. Ancient Egypt, I should say. Times of the pyramids. We have a couple of thousand years worth of Nile River flood data. Now, if you look at that data, it shows these sorts of properties. It shows these correlations over long timescales. And so people come up with various funky names for this phenomena based on biblical stories when the Israelites were in Egypt and so on. I'm not going to really bother with all of that. But in that case, you have 1,000 years or 2,000 years of history. People have shown this sort of property when they look at weather statistics, for instance. Things like droughts. We're experiencing a really nasty drought at the moment here. And droughts seem to follow this sort of long-range correlation process where you see them being correlated over long time periods. The other nice thing about this decay function is there are nice theorems which allow us to relate the autocorrelation function to the Fourier transform, or the spectral density. We just need to take the Fourier transform of this thing and we will get the spectral density. When we do that, we get a spectral density. We get a spectral density which has a singularity at zero. These are just pictures of the autocorrelation functions on various different scales. So we get a picture like this. What this means is that as we go towards zero frequency, the power goes up and up and up and up. People sometimes call this 1 on S noise for the case when alpha is equal to 1. When alpha is equal to 1, you get a 1 on S spectral density. And again, this 1 on S noise appears in a whole bunch of different areas. So you can get cases though when alpha is not equal to 1, and people often still call that 1 on S noise by abuse of the terminology. If you think about the different sorts of possibilities here, you can have white noise. White noise has a flat spectral density. Brownian motion, the standard Brownian motion, would have a spectral density which looks like 1 on F squared. The sort of things we're interested in, people sometimes call them pink noise because they're somewhere between white and brown. It's kind of a funky name. Actually, you would look at 1 on F to the alpha, where alpha is some particular parameter. So this would be the spectral density, for instance, of white noise. This is our white Gaussian noise. This is its spectrum on a normal picture, linear scales, and this is the log-log axis. The reason we use log-log axes is because these power laws look like straight lines. So you can see we have roughly flat spectral density, although there's a lot of noise around that. This red line is showing you the level of significance, or the slope of that line. This is the spectral density for H equals 0.75, and you can see it looks like this. Better one is 0.99. You can see we get quite a big slope here. So you can see that as frequency decreases, you have more and more power. So the thing about this is why it doesn't respond to that low pass operation, that smoothing. Smoothing doesn't work here because smoothing is a low pass. It's getting rid of these frequencies down here. But not much of the power is in these frequencies. Remember, this is a log axis on the Y scale. So not much power is down here. A lot of the power is in these low frequencies. So this is an interesting noise process because it does put so much of its power in these low frequencies. You can imagine denoising something where you had this sort of noise in it would be very, very difficult. You can't just do a high pass filter. Makes your life a lot more difficult if this is the sort of noise that you have to deal with. Why do we care about it? Well, typically 1/f noise or self-similar noise, it isn't a problem in the sense of being noise that's added to a processor, although it could be, and you have to be aware of that possibility. It's a problem when you have the noise itself that's interesting to you. So typically when you look at something that has this property, it's the thing that has this 1/f property that's interesting. So for instance, music to some extent has this sort of property. Cardiac rhythms and healthy hearts have this property. This is a really interesting thing. You think about your heartbeat. We can think of a heartbeat as a really regular thing. Every, I don't know, second you have a heartbeat. But actually, the rhythm of your heartbeat changes over time. When I'm standing up here walking around, my heart is probably going faster than for you guys who are sitting in the audience not doing anything. And then I'll go back to my office and I'll sit down and my heart will slow down. So the actual rhythms of our heart looked at over long time periods can be seen as a sort of noise process. For a healthy heart, you see this type of statistical behavior where you have long-range dependence or self-similarity. If you see a heart which is going boom, 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 boom every second over a long period, it's very regular, what that shows you is there's something unhealthy about that heart, because the heart is not adapting to what the person is doing. So this is one way people use to actually detect certain sorts of arrhythmias that actually occur, they look more regular than this sort of heartbeat. As I said, we've seen this in hydrological data, rainfall data and so on. Music seems to have this. Various sorts of turbulence seem to have this sort of property. Financial models are starting to use these sorts of ideas to try and model financial data series. And you can see in finance, you really would be interested in this noise, because if you can predict the noise, you can make a lot of money. So understanding these sorts of properties can be very, very useful to people. And that's what we allow ourselves to do by doing some sort of statistical analysis. There's a direct connection to fractals. I'm not going to go into it because you guys probably haven't spent much time doing fractals. Fractional Gaussian noise, the natural way of detecting this sort of phenomena is to use wavelets. What we were talking about was the fractional Gaussian noise process, and the fact that you saw this sort of power law in the spectrum. So this is the spectral density of our fractional Gaussian noise, and you can see that we see this straight line. We have a log-log scale here. So this is a nice model for a lot of physical processes. It's used significantly often in telecommunications, modeling telecommunications traffic, like similar sort of processes. It's used in a bunch of other areas. So there are a large number of these sort of example applications of this sort of 1/f type noise, ranging from Hurst's early work on hydrological data, and I think I mentioned the Nile River in the last lecture, all the way to looking at things like musical scores and the fact that they seem to exhibit self-similar like patterns. Most recently, I guess, people have started applying these sorts of models to financial data with a view to being able to do things like predict the stock market. And you can see that very, very large sums of money would be involved in being able to develop good models. But more than just developing good models, you have to be able to estimate these parameters. In particular, the Hurst parameter is a very important parameter here. You can see it determines the slope of this line. So one naive way of estimating the Hurst parameter would be simply to take these points and do a regression to look for a straight line. And that will give you an estimate of the slope of that line, which tells you the Hurst parameter. On the other hand, these data points aren't all independent data points. One of the assumptions hidden in regression is that you have a bunch of points along a line with some random noise, uncorrelated random noise added to them. here the noise added to these points is very highly correlated, and so any regression on this set of data points won't work as well as you might hope it would. So what I really want to point out, and I started pointing this out at the end of the last lecture, is that we can use wavelets to estimate Hurst parameters. And the reason for this is related to this multi-resolution approximation view of wavelets. So in the multi-resolution approximation view, one simple way of doing multi-resolution approximation is you simply take blocks of data and you take the average over that block of data. And then you take a larger block by a factor of two and so on. And the Haar wavelet decomposition allows you to do this in a very efficient way. So this gives you a way of doing multi-resolution approximation, but also we know the statistics of those approximations because of this scaling property of the self-similar process. So this allows us, by taking our wavelet transform, to get a picture of the scaling behavior in the data. Another way of thinking about it is as sub-band filters. Remember, we're looking at a in the frequency domain, we're looking at a picture where we get a straight line. You notice we have a log X and a log Y scale on this picture, though. How do we get the log Y scale? Well, that's easy. You just take the log of some set of values. How do you get the log X scale? Well, we have to divide the frequency spectrum into logarithmically sized bands. And that's another thing the wavelet transform does. Remember, we looked at what the wavelet filters do as a bunch of band pass filters, and our first wavelet will chop off the top half of the frequency, the second one the top half of the remainder, the top half of the next remainder, and so on down to the approximation. So they're chopping off logarithmic chunks of this spectrum. So if I look at the amount of power in here versus the amount of power in here, amount of power in here, it's equivalent of having a log X axis on my picture. So this is the same picture with a log frequency axis along the bottom. So this is just the math that goes into it, and I don't expect you to remember this math. What I expect you to remember is this sort of picture. And what's this picture showing us? Well, what we have along here, this is the octave J. So you can see actually the frequency has been reversed along this picture. Frequency, we're talking about high frequency down here and low frequency up here. Yeah, grab a set of notes. There's notes out the front. Excuse me? There's notes out the front. Grab yourself a set. So we have the frequencies reversed here. And you see we have this straight line. We have a log y-axis here. It's the log of this mu minus g, which I'm not going to tell you what they are. I have the formula there, but as I stated, you don't have to remember those formulas. They're really just power. So what we're really looking at is power in each of those wavelet subbands. What else have we got here? Well, the simplistic view of this self-similarity property is that you have this scaling law over all scales. But actually, in reality, typically you don't see it over all scales. Quite often, you see some scales which don't fit into this straight line. And when we plot it like this, you can see those very clearly. They don't fit into this straight line. You also get these vertical lines here, which are confidence intervals for those data points. So because this is a carefully derived statistical estimator, rather than we're just going to do an ad hoc regression, we know the confidence intervals for each of these guys. And so we can do a weighted regression. We give less weight to this point because the errors are larger for that point. And we give much more weight to this point when we're doing our regression. So this has some very nice properties in terms of performing estimates of Hurst parameters. And this is one of those things where wavelets really come into their own. Wavelets really have a whole bunch of properties that are really useful here. For instance, one of the things that is a standard confounding factor for doing estimates of things like Hurst parameters is if you have a trend in the data. There are actually technically more accurate estimators. There's an estimator called the Whittle estimator, which is the maximum likelihood estimator for the Hurst parameter. So in fact, in some sense, that's better than this estimator, slightly more accurate. But if you have a trend in your data and you apply the Whittle estimator to it, the Whittle estimator produces crap. This estimator, what do you do with wavelets if you have a trend in the data? Anyone remember what we can do with wavelets? Think a little bit more about the fact we can design our wavelets. We can choose wavelets with a two vanishing moments. If you have two vanishing moments, then a linear trend will just pass through them. It will vanish when we look at this picture. So it won't affect this estimator. This estimator has a whole bunch of these sort of nice properties. It's really one of those applications that wavelets were really just designed to be able to do. So this is the actual estimator that you perform. It's almost as accurate as the Whittle estimator. It does some nice things. It jointly estimates H and this other parameter that you have, which tells you the magnitude of the variations. It's equivalent to measuring the variance of the process at the same time. This known variance of estimates, because we have those confidence intervals for those individual points on the regression, we also get a confidence interval for the estimate of H, which is very useful for us. And this robustness property, this is something that's really critical when you're dealing with real data. Again, whenever you have real data, it never quite does what you want it to do. Maybe it has a trend in the data, or maybe it's non-Gaussian. We've been talking about Gaussian processes, fractional Gaussian noise, white noise, and so on. Gaussian processes. What if the data is not Gaussian? Can you still apply these ideas? And the answer is yes, but something like the Whittle estimator won't work anymore, whereas this wavelet estimator will still tend to work quite well. It accommodates short-range correlation structures or high-frequency structures such as this, which don't fit into this regression, this simple straight line pattern on the log-log picture. And there's some good code out there. There's some free MATLAB code for doing these estimates, so you don't really have to go and implement this sort of thing for yourself. So what I'm really trying to indicate here is that wavelets and applications of wavelets go beyond the sort of standard things that people do, like compression. Wavelets can do some things, I mean, they do compression perhaps better than the Fourier transform, but wavelets can do some things that you just can't do with a Fourier transform. Doing the Fourier transform view of this and trying to do that regression, you end up getting hopelessly bad results because of the correlation structure and the values that you're trying to do the regression on. Wavelets will do a much better job for you. Okay, so we're touching on a few topics in this lecture, and I'm really just touching on them because I want you to have your eyes a little bit opened to some of the possibilities. Well, one of those is the fact that so far we have concentrated very, very much on uniform sampling. That's, you know, we have sampling interval bang, 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 exactly the same distance apart. What happens if that's not the case? Well, let's first understand why it is that we have these uniform sampling intervals. Firstly, we have this Nyquist result. Nyquist wrote this paper in 1928, which revealed this result. It gave you this idea that you had to sample twice as fast as this highest frequency, or the bandwidth of the signal that you were sampling. But I think Claude Shannon is the guy who really nailed this. So sometimes people call this the Shannon-Nyquist sort of result, or Shannon-Nyquist theorem. Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, he really worked out quite a lot of things that are related to signals and how we can represent signals and so on. But the important thing from our point of view is his sampling theorem. And what the sampling theorem says is something like this. If we have a function f that contains no frequencies higher than w, it's completely determined by giving its ordinates. The ordinates just means the values of the function at a series of points 1 on 2w apart. Now, that's just the same result that we've been talking about, the Nyquist result. If we have a frequency that's band limited by w, you sample it 2 times w, and you don't lose any information. No aliasing happens. So we don't lose any information when we do that. Another way of saying that is that the function is completely determined. We started talking about non-standard sampling and the fact that you can sample at various other ways besides the perfect uniform sampling that we've been talking about for the majority of our classes. When we start talking about irregular sampling, that is sampling that's not on any particular grid, that could be in some way random, we use a thing called the Lomb-Skargl periodogram. So I introduced the Lomb-Skargl periodogram, and as I said, I don't expect you to remember a formula like this. I wouldn't remember this formula. I would go and look it up. But there's some important things about this Lomb-Skargl periodogram that allow us to do sampling like this, even though we don't do a bandpass filter before we do the sampling. So the trick here is, we need a bandpass filter to stop aliasing, but aliasing is a phenomenon which is associated with these nice uniform samples. When we don't have nice uniform sampling, our life somehow gets easier. This is a kind of attempt to get an intuitive understanding of why that is. There are better ways, I think, of understanding this, but I think this is a good starting point. And I was just explaining this at the end of the last lecture, so let me repeat myself quickly. We have, perhaps we start with some uniform sampling points, evenly spaced. But there's some error in the timing of our uniformly sampled points. So instead of sampling exactly here, maybe we sample over on this side of this interval or this side of this interval. So One way of thinking about that is it introduces an error. The same way quantization introduces an error into our samples. This introduces an error into the value. And we can see from this particular picture that the error is going to be of a similar order of magnitude to the error that we have in the jitter here. It's not going to be exactly the same, obviously, but it's going to be an order of magnitude around the same sort of size. So, you know, we have an error like this, and that produces an error like this, similar sort of size. So for low frequencies, jitter just looks like noise. It looks like errors. It looks like some sort of additional noise in the process. Maybe it's not white. Maybe we have some sort of structure to that noise, but typically when you get noise like this, people would just model it as white noise. So maybe we introduce some white noise, some additional noise into our signal by having noise in the timing of our samples. That's okay. We can live with that. We know about noise. We know what to do about it. It'd be nice to get rid of it, but we can deal with it. What happens to the high frequencies? So here I have the same sort of size error in my timing of my sample. But you can see that if I chose this point, the value I would get would be down here, whereas if I chose this point, the value is up here. So the errors now are much, much bigger than the error in the sample time. The errors are now as big as the signal. So now it's not really like adding noise into the signal, it's just all we will see is noise. So these high frequencies, rather than looking like a signal plus some noise, they're kind of being converted into noise. And that noise is being aliased into our results. So these high frequencies are in some sense not being taken away, they're being smoothed away by this randomness in the sampling process. So this is one way. In this case, I start with uniform samples and say I have some error in my sampling time, which I don't know about. But in general, we say that we have some sample points where we know the exact sample time, and we construct this Lomb-Skargl periodogram. So this intuitive picture doesn't tell you everything that you need to know. There's another way of looking at this that I'm going to try and describe in a minute. But essentially this view, the Lomb-Skargl periodogram, think of it as fitting cosines and sines to your data. This works regardless. you can always fit some curve to your data regardless of aliasing or any of those sort of artifacts. You're just fitting a curve to the data. What happens is you fit curves? Well, we're not really fitting one cosine curve to our data. We're fitting a whole bunch of possible cosines to that data and seeing which one's best. It would be confusing, to say the least, if we tried to fit a million cosine curves to 10 data points. Then you're estimating a million parameters with 10 data points. It's very ill-posed. There's probably an infinite number of possible solutions that you could fit and get exactly the right solution there. So in some sense, when we do this sort of fitting, we're hoping that the solution that we're going to find is sparse. It's relatively simple. There's not too much to it. I'll talk about that a bit more in a second. Here's our Lomsdagen periodogram. You can see it pulls out the right frequency. How do we test whether or not this is doing the right thing? Because this is no longer a strict periodogram in the sense that we're used to dealing with. So how do we test whether or not it does the right thing? Well, we have our periodogram. It has a spike here. We're going to guess that this is some sort of fundamental. This is the most strong spike. You can see this regular pattern of other spikes here. Are they particular frequencies in the data? Well, there must be something to them, but maybe we can understand these other spikes in terms of something along the lines of harmonics. So let's see if we can model the data as some sort of periodic signal with this period. This seems like the strongest one in the set of data. Okay. How can we test this? Well, there's a simple idea called a folded plot. The idea of a folded plot is I take some sort of periodic signal and I just fold it up. So this bit is on top of this and this bit is on top of this. So we would take a picture like that and I'd end up with one repetition. Now imagine these were my samples. The green sample would appear here, the red sample here, and the brown sample here, even though they're not in that order here. They've just been folded so they're on top of each other. If the data is actually periodic and you have a lot of samples spread over time, you'll end up with a lot of samples sprinkled over this curve. If the data is not periodic, or you have the period wrong, you'll just get samples spread over this whole interval. So this is a neat way of just testing whether or not your signal has a particular periodicity in it. You notice this is not linked to it being sine-based or cosines or any particular function. This is just saying it has this period. And you could do it with this period as well. Then you just get two repetitions of this signal. So what I've done with my picture is I've continued it on just to give you a little idea so you can see these little bits as well. So this is the picture for the astronomical data, and you can see this very strong periodic bit, and I just continued it on a little bit so that you get a little bit more view of this data as a periodic signal. And you can see that these measurements, these are the variability measurements we started with, you can see that they cluster very strongly around a particular curve. There's some noise there, but that's to be expected. We have some signal which has some noise on top. So this is very good evidence that this period of 11.7 cycles per day is real. And yet, as I pointed out, 11.7 cycles per day is orders of magnitude above the Nyquist frequency if you just took the average number of measurements that we have available here. So this Lomsdagen periodogram is working. It's doing what we want it to do. Irregular sampling comes in other contexts. So we talked maybe very briefly about computer-generated imagery, CGI imagery. CGI is used in all sorts of movies these days. Lord of the Rings is the classic one people talk about a lot, but it's used in all of these movies like Shrek, which has been used in Madagascar. There are dozens of movies coming out each year now which seem to use CGI or a very large component of CGI. So with CGI, what we're essentially doing is creating some geometrical objects. For instance, This is a picture of a brandy glass, and it's, you can see it's a very simple geometric object. There's a kind of checkerboard pattern in the background, that's also a simple geometric object. Simple geometric shape. And then we sample from that picture to produce the pixels of this image. So each pixel here is one sample of that underlying geometric shape. There is a real problem here though. Those underlying geometric shapes, you can see, this has sharp edges. An edge means that you have all of these higher frequencies in there. In the background here, you see we have this regular pattern. As you go further into the background, because of perspective, that pattern is getting finer and finer and finer. So back here, this pattern has a very high frequency, much higher than the sampling rate that we're sampling at. So as I pointed out earlier on in the course, this can result in aliasing and imaging, and aliasing and imaging results in a number of different sorts of phenomena like jaggies along diagonal edges. It also results in moiré patterns and various other sorts of types of aliasing. So we have this basic problem of we're sampling something. The ideal thing to do would be to run a low-pass filter and then do the sampling. That's quite computationally hard to do with a computer-generated image. These images, each one of these pixels requires quite a lot of computational effort. If we were going to have some underlying geometric thing which we pass through a low-pass filter so it becomes kind of a blurrier version of itself, that would make the computational load of these infeasible in a lot of cases. So running this low-pass filter is not always a practical way of doing it. An alternative that people have used in the sort of CGI area is supersampling with some jittering. So what they do is, rather than sample on a regular grid, what they do is they sample with some slight randomness in the sample position. Okay, so that randomness in the sample positions does exactly what we've been talking about earlier on, back here. The randomness in a sampling grid means that these high frequencies get turned into noise, the low frequencies we get a little bit of error in them, a little bit of error, the high frequencies get turned into noise, so we no longer have the aliasing problem. The aliasing problem gets reduced. But if you just sample on an irregular grid, you'll just get noise. You'll still get a picture, but you'll get a picture with quite a lot of noise added onto it. Adding the noise onto the picture will make it look kind of ugly. So what do you do? Well, you super sample, which means you sample at a higher rate than the actual pixels that you want to display, and then you do a little average over some set of pixels. Why do you do an average? Well, that average will tend to reduce the noise. Remember, if we have white noise in our process, it will tend to reduce that high frequency component of the noise. There's a low pass on the data. That low pass will get rid of those high frequency noise terms that we've been introducing by doing our jittering in our sample. So this is one of those sort of techniques that a lot of people use in the context of generating CGI, but I think very few people really understand why it works. So you're getting a bit of an insight into that sort of technique. You randomly jitter where your samples are going to be, but you do it at a higher rate than you need to, then you average over some small group of those samples such that you can generate this image at the end of the day. I have a little comment here. Why you don't use this for animations, you use it for still pictures. Why wouldn't you use it for animations? What's that? Too slow is a big issue because you're introducing more things. But part of the issue is when you have an animation, you also have the time dimension. So you really have a three-dimensional set of data then. So if I just jitter in the spatial dimension and then I look over time, I could run into aliasing artifacts in time as well. One of the sorts of things that we saw earlier on was this example of crawling ants. Another thing is you might get, because you're randomizing the locations of these pixels when you're doing the sampling here, from one image to the next, the value is going to change a little bit. but maybe this pixel will go from being light to dark to light to dark. And that will create this creepy little sort of speckling effect in the animation. So if you do this sort of thing with an animation, you have to make sure that you use the same jitter over time. So you have to be very careful about how you do this sort of thing when you're creating realistic images or realistic animation. There are a myriad of other possibilities for sampling. Classic example of sampling problem is that when we sample onto a 2D rectangular grid, the distance between the pixels is not even. So if you look at your horizontal pixels, they're one sampling interval apart. But if you look diagonally, their square root 2 is the distance between the centers of those pixels. So the sampling in that rectangular grid, horizontally and vertically you've got a particular sampling interval, but diagonally you've got a different sampling interval. Remember, the sampling interval is really important. It's this Nyquist frequency. So the sampling interval is different in different directions. We will see different artifacts in different directions, different properties of that signal in different directions. So it would be much nicer to have a more symmetric way of sampling, where the direction didn't matter quite so much. Likewise, there are some devices for which pixels are much more circular. So a classic example, this might be a printer. It's very hard for a printer to make a little rectangular dot. Remember, these are micro dots, these are tiny. But it's hard to make a rectangular dot, much easier to make a circular dot. You just spray a little tiny blob of ink onto the page, and that will give you a circle. So it's much easier sometimes to make circular pixels or circular samples or circular objects when you're doing these things. Sometimes it's easier when you're scanning to have little circular images that you scan. The elements of your CCD camera may not be exactly rectangular. This is another common problem, is that it might be hard to make your little semiconductor device have this exactly rectangular shape. So having a grid which is rectangular isn't always the best possible choice. Another choice is to have a hexagonal grid. And in fact, there's obviously any tessellation of the plane you could use as your grid. People are mostly interested in regular tessellations. The two obvious ones are the rectangular grid and the hexagonal grid. So a hexagonal grid is probably the next best alternative to rectangular. I don't know what you'd do with the other ones. I don't know the practical applications of them. But the hexagonal grid does get used sometimes. It has some other advantages. If you think about angular resolution, with a rectangular grid, you really have 0, 45, 90 degrees, 135, 180 degrees. You have 45 degree angular resolution when you look between pixels, adjacent pixels. With a hexagonal grid, you get the sort of every 30 degree picture of the pixels. So you can see some advantages to hexagonal grids. So how do we actually construct a hexagonal grid? Well, it's useful to know how to construct a hexagonal grid from a rectangular grid, or vice versa. And it's relatively easy to do. All we have to do is we take our rectangular grid, we rotate it by 45 degrees, and then we stretch it this way. And then each of these sample points will fit into a hexagonal grid. Why is it important that we be able to construct it like this? Well, now that I can construct it like this, I know how to do Fourier transforms on this hexagonal grid. It might have been a bit confusing to do a Fourier transform with the hexagonal data, because remember, I want these nice separable bases. With a hexagonal grid, it wasn't really obvious to me to start with how you generate a separable basis of cosines and sines, that is. But if I know this picture, it's really easy, because I know how these transforms affect the Fourier transform. Remember, if I do a rotation in 2D of the signal, that's like rotating the Fourier transform as well. So this rotation is just a rotation of the Fourier transform. I know what I do when I stretch in the time domain or the spatial domain. When I stretch in the time domain, I squeeze in the Fourier domain. So that's what I have to do here. And I've stretched it out this way, and I've squeezed it in a bit this way. So the Fourier transform will have exactly the opposite. It will be squeezed in this way and stretched out this way. So once I have my Fourier set of my data points here, I know how to do the Fourier transform. One very simple way is I simply transform this to here. I do the Fourier transform on the rectangular grid, and then I transform the Fourier transform back to here. And that will give me a Fourier transform on the hexagonal grid. So that's all this slide is really saying, is that I have these transforms between the two. Okay, so that was just a couple of 2D examples to give you an idea that this irregular sampling or these different sampling patterns are applicable in more than one dimension. In fact, they get kind of more interesting in two dimensions. And I could imagine that they would be very interesting in three or four dimensions, but I don't typically deal with data like that. But you can imagine that you might have some data that's atmospheric data that's sampled in three dimensions. And that data may be easier to deal with if you have some sort of non-rectangular grid. Okay, so the other thing that I want us to think about a bit is this Lorentz-Skogel periodogram. As I kind of hinted, There's something in here that's a bit deeper than what I've talked about so far. The Lorentz-Skogel periodogram is trying to do something. It's trying to pull out this simple representation of the data for us, if it exists. So I need to tell you a little bit about that, and I'm going to call it a sparse description of data. And this comes down to why we do transforms again. So I've given you a couple of reasons for doing transforms, but this is probably one of the most important. Why do you do a transform? Well, you take something that's complicated, some signal that's got all of this stuff happening in it, and you do a transform, and it looks really simple, hopefully. If that's the case, then going so to the Fourier domain, you get this simple representation of your data, and that simple representation of your data is very, very powerful. It lets you describe the data easily. It lets you understand the data. It's simple, and so I can understand it. I can't understand complicated things. I need nice, simple things to be able to understand it. So you take your complicated data, you turn it into something simple, you can understand what's going on there. What's more, you have this sparse description of the signal. Okay, as soon as you have a sparse description, sparse means you don't need very many numbers. Like, that means you can compress the signal. If I can come up with this sparse description of my signal, then clearly it must be very compressible. And that's what we're exploiting in things like JPEG. We're exploiting the fact that most of the information is in a few of those coefficients in the transform domain. And the rest of the information, maybe there's a bit of information there, but it's not very important. So I can just get rid of it. Ignore it. So this is, if we have a signal with this sort of sparse description, then suddenly we have a whole lot of powerful things, analysis, compression, and so on, that we can do with that signal. What we've done so far in this course is we've built transforms that go from one orthonormal basis to another orthonormal basis, typically. There are good reasons for doing that. One is that, you know, you have no redundancy then. There's no wasted data in transform space. Another one is the ones we've looked at typically are computationally efficient. And part of the reason for that is that they don't have to calculate a huge number of extra things. But this non-redundancy sometimes hurts us a bit. So I'll tell you a bit about that in a second, why it's sometimes better to have a redundancy in that transform, and that can lead to a sparser representation for our data. Okay, so let me give you a little example. This is a sine wave, and this is its representation in the Fourier domain. Two sine waves. Four sine waves. So now you start hopefully to see what I mean. this is a very complicated looking signal. To tell someone about this signal in the time domain, I have to show them all of these points. I have to tell them all of those points. What's more, I look at this signal and I don't really understand what's going on there. But if I look at it in the Fourier domain, four numbers really tell me the story. Given those four numbers, I kind of know what's going on here. So this is a sparse representation of that signal. Also, if I wanted to compress this signal, one way of doing it would be to try and find some clever way of encoding all of these bits, Huffman coding or arithmetic coding or something like this. Another way is I just write down these four numbers. Well, I have to write down the frequencies as well, so eight numbers. But it's a hell of a lot less data than this whole signal. So you can see that this sparsity of the representation is a good thing. But it doesn't always work. Part of the problem with sparse signal representations is what I do with something like this. So this is a sine wave, and I've added a spike in here. So let's think about transforming this. What we kind of hope is we choose, say, the Fourier transform or the wavelet transform, we transform it, we get a sparse representation. But does that happen here? If we do a Fourier transform, so this is the function sine plus a delta, if we do a Fourier transform of a delta, what are we going to get? We get a complex exponential. So that's got terms at all frequencies. The power of it is spread over all frequencies, this delta. The sine just converts into one delta in the time domain, in the frequency domain. So if I take the transform of this, I get, from this bit I get a delta, and from this bit I get a complex exponential, another sinusoid. So in the frequency domain, the signal looks pretty much the same. Qualitatively it looks the same. It looks like a kind of periodic part plus a spike. So when I do the Fourier transform of this signal, I don't get a sparser representation of the signal. I just get something that looks pretty much the same. And it's pretty hard to work out one of these transforms where you would get a sparse description of the data. It's pretty hard to say. I mean, the wavelet transform wouldn't fix this problem for us. The wavelet transform would produce a whole lot of large number of coefficients. Which ones of them are important or not important? Well, maybe some of them would be unimportant, we could get rid of them, but there'd still be a significant number which had meaningful power in them. So that wouldn't get us a sparse representation. In fact, I don't know of any orthonormal basis off the top of my head, but I do know the sparse representation here. The sparse representation of this signal is it's a sine plus a delta. The problem here is this comes from this sort of time domain representation, this comes from the Fourier domain representation. So my sparse description of the data, it's mixing two bases together. It's taking a time domain basis, this spike basis, this basis of time domain sort of representation, and this Fourier domain representation, it's mixing them together. And there's no way of getting, just designing off the top of my head a basis which would solve this problem. I mean, I could design a basis which solves this problem. It would have this delta function and this sine function. Wouldn't be an orthonormal basis anymore. So if there's no way of designing a priori a basis for doing this, is there a way of finding this sparse representation even though I don't know the right basis? So there is a thing out there called basis pursuit, and the idea of basis pursuit is we're going to try and find this particular basis that's good for representing this function. So we're going to start with some much larger set of basic functions. We'll call them something like atoms. We've talked about atoms before. We call them atomic functions. They're going to be the things that we build other things out of. Same way you build molecules out of atoms. And we're going to choose the best bits out of a couple of bases. In this case, two bases, but we could say 100 different bases. We could take the Fourier basis and the wavelet basis and the time domain basis. We could take all of these things and we could mix them together, and we could say pick out the best bits of those bases. Now the problem with that problem, the way I've set it so far, is there's an infinite number of ways. Once I have a non-redundant, once I have a redundant set of functions, one of the problems with this redundant set of functions is I end up with an infinite number of possible ways of representing my function in terms of my atomic function. So I need some criteria to allow me to choose one of them, to say this is the best representation, even though there's an infinite number of possible ways I could write my function. Just for example, here I can write it like this, or I could write it in the Fourier domain, or I could write it just as a time domain thing like this. There's a large number of possible ways I could write it. What is it that makes this best? Well, the thing that makes this best is it's sparse. So what I'm going to do is say, let's find a, I'll call it a basis for the second, but we'll find some group of functions to represent this. And we're going to do so in a way that maximizes the sparsity of the representation. So we have this notion of a dictionary. I've mentioned this before, but the idea is with a dictionary with words, it allows you to describe words, and you typically do that in terms of other words and sentences. We're going to simplify that a bit. We're going to have some sort of dictionary for our signals, but we're going to write our dictionary in terms of atomic functions, atoms, these guys. And we're going to make sure that all of our signals are written as linear combination of those atoms, just to make this a simpler sort of problem for us to deal with. So we're going to write our signal in terms of these atoms. Remember, these atoms are no longer a basis. There's a lot of redundancy in them. So there's an infinite number of possible ways of doing this, perhaps. So what we're going to do now is we're going to search that dictionary, search that space of possible solutions for one that maximizes the sparsity. So writing that as an optimization problem, what I want to do is minimize this sum such that my signal X is written in terms of a linear combination of these atomic functions. And you notice that this sum just adds up all the places where the alphas are not zero. So this is just saying minimize the number of terms in this sum. Minimize the number of atomic functions I need. Minimize the number of bits I need to put into my signal. So this is exactly what I've been talking about. This is maximizing the sparsity. This thing is a measure of the sparsity. By minimizing this, I'm maximizing the sparsity of my solution. And this is just saying that the signal still has to be represented in terms of those functions. Just a very quick refresher on norms. We have a bunch of different norms that we've talked about over time. These are what we call the LP norms, where we have a simple Rn sort of space that's our signal with length n, or n data points, or a vector of length n. We take the absolute value of those terms to the power of p, we add them together, and we take the pth root of that signal. And this gives us our norm p. We call it the LP norm. So the L2 norm is simply, think of it like the Euclidean distance. It's just the sum of the squares and take the square root. The L1 norm is just the sum of the absolute values of our signal. The L0 norm is this sparsity measure. This thing here is an L0 norm. It just tells us how many of our terms are non-zero. So this thing is our sparsity measure. Just counts the number of terms. The problem with this optimization problem is it's not a convex optimization problem. It's an NP-hard, non-polynomial. There's no polynomial time algorithm for solving this optimization problem. So it's not feasible for us to do this. There's a combinatoric explosion if you try and do it. The number of possible solutions is going to be exponential in the number in how many of these atomic functions we have. And so determining which ones to use out of all of these possible solutions requires searching through a very, very large space. And that's not practical for us to do in any sort of reasonable amount of time for realistic signals. One of the really clever results of the last few years, this is very recent, one of the really clever results of the last few years is showing that we can, well, this is our problem again, this is minimizing the L0 norm of our signal. Oops, these should be alphas in here. They're the things that we want to minimize the sparsity of. This is the thing that we want to solve. One of the really clever results of the last few years is showing that this can be often approximated by solving the L1 norm. So you see, the only difference between these two guys is here we have the L0 norm, here we have the L1 norm. So you say, well, isn't that obvious? Shouldn't they be the same? Well, actually, norms make a lot of difference. A different norm could mean you have a very different solution. If I put the L2 norm in here, I would get a very, very different solution. It's just very nice for us that in a lot of cases this L0 norm is approximated by this L1 norm in terms of solving this optimization problem. Now, the nice thing about using the L1 norm is I can rewrite this optimization problem like this. Minimize the sum over a set of epsilons such that my signal X is still, this is still the same condition, my signal should be the linear combination of these atomic functions, but also minimize these epsilons such that the alphas lie between the epsilons. That's the same optimization problem in those two cases. I'll let you sit down and go through that just to convince yourself that that's the case. The nice thing about this is a simple linear program. Now, you guys should have been taught how to solve linear programs. To some extent, you probably saw these in first year. But there are really powerful techniques like simplex for solving these problems that you probably only see in second year, maybe third year. Simplex, interior point methods, various other methods for solving these problems are very, very, very fast. They can solve quite large problems, problems with tens of thousands of variables. And so this makes it practical for us to solve this type of problem. Here's a little example that I cooked up for us. This is a sine wave again with a spike in it, although I sampled it here so that I have discrete data. And this is the result of the L1 minimization. This is the Fourier basis, this is the spike basis. You can see I have a spike here at frequency 3. That corresponds to my sine. And I have a spike here, which is the actual spike. So now I have a representation of my signal where I have to remember two numbers. I have a sparse representation of my signal. Does this L1 norm minimization always work? Well, I think the answer to that is a research question at the moment. Interestingly, I don't know if you guys heard about this, but there's a guy called Terence Taylor who's Australian. He's actually from Adelaide. And he won the Fields Medal this year. The Fields Medal is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for mathematics. So it's a pretty huge honour to win the Fields Medal. They only offer it every 4 years in this case. So he won this Fields Medal very recently, a few months ago. And one of the things that he's been working on is this type of problem. So this involves some really serious, some very interesting mathematics, but it's also got some really nice applications. So one of the sorts of applications it's been used for is detecting anomalies in traffic data. With traffic data, you frequently see periodic behavior. For instance, you see daily cycles, or diurnal cycles, people call these. You see people go to sleep at night, and so they're not downloading stuff off the internet when they're asleep. Mostly they're not downloading stuff off the internet when they're asleep. So the traffic at night may go down, the traffic during the day increases. A lot of business traffic during the day. You see sometimes for domestic traffic, for household internet traffic, you see peaks in the evening when people go home from work. And they can download things to their house then. So you see these daily cycles, you also see weekly cycles and so on. You also see in internet traffic occasionally you see big spikes, and these correspond to things like big worms. A big internet worm can create a lot of traffic, and that creates a spike in the traffic. Well, sometimes you see these spikes when there's a denial of service attack. Denial of service is when someone sends a lot of packets to pound, say, Yahoo is a big famous example from a few years ago. Someone sent a large number of packets towards them to stop anyone else's packets from getting there. So these cause spikes in the data. So one way of detecting these would be to use the same sort of time series algorithms, filtering algorithms that we've been talking about for the whole course. Another way would be to decompose our signal into this periodic basis and the spike basis. And the spike basis would tell us the anomalies, and periodic basis would tell us the ordinary part, the bit that we normally look at. Why does it work? I'm not the right person to tell you this. It's still, I think, a research question. I'm not really even going to try and explain this in any more detail, but it's to do with the fact that the L1 norm and the L0 norm to do with the fact that when you have a sparse solution, then that sparse solution lies in a particular hyperplane in your n-dimensional Euclidean space. And what the L0 norm is doing is it's searching through all of the possible hyperplanes that you could use. The L1 norm is simply looking for a solution which sits in a hyperplane which satisfies, which minimizes this L1 norm. The two turn out, when you have this sparse solution, to be approximately equivalent. Does that mean it always works? Well, one of the things I found when I sat down and wrote a little bit of MATLAB code to test this out, to generate this example, is that it worked fine when I had about 32 data points. When I increased that to about 1,000 data points, I tended to get garbage out of it. So there's clearly some numerical issues here that still worth working on. So there's a lot of sort of interesting research topics sitting around here. How does this relate to the Lomsdagen periodogram? Well, what are we trying to do with the Lomsdagen periodogram? Well, if you think about it, what we're really trying to do is come up with a sparse description of our data in terms of periodicities. But we have a much larger dictionary than a basis, because we're allowing, remember, if we have n data points, the standard Nyquist frequency would let us have n frequencies, n frequency bins in the Fourier domain. So we would have our n things that we could look at there. So this is our nice orthonormal transform. We transform n data points to n data points. With the Lomsdagen periodogram, we consider frequencies well above the Nyquist frequency. So we're allowing basis functions or atomic functions over a much wider range of possibilities than we had in our original signal. But we're hoping that our signal has this simple, sparse representation. So in the astronomical data case, essentially I'm looking for one period. So not just a simple sine wave, but a sine wave and some harmonics, perhaps. I'm looking for a simple representation of my data. Now, what I'm doing with the Lomsdagen periodogram is a kind of L2 norm minimization. It's a least squares fit of all of these possibilities to the data. But perhaps there's a way of doing this via an L1 norm minimization. And I don't think anyone has really considered that. So I wanted to leave you at the end of these lectures with the idea that this is not a closed off research area. There are a lot of open problems here, a lot of very interesting problems. They involve some very, very sophisticated, clever mathematics, but at the same time, there's some really practical applications for these sort of results.